time ago that the test would be the first Thursday in May. Now, somebody was thinking that's getting too near the final exam. They'd rather have it tomorrow. I wonder how many of you would. Would you raise your hand, any who'd rather have it tomorrow? There's just one hand raised, so I think we better stick to the date originally announced. So it'd be a week from tomorrow, and that leaves only about 10 or 12 days between that and the final exam. So that if you're well prepared for that test, you probably will not have to spend a tremendous amount of time in further review for the final exam. Now we're speaking about this argument from history. And we notice that the claim that Bellhausen and those... would you shut the door, please, when you come in? Thank you. We've noticed that the arguments that Bellhausen and those who have followed him make is that as you look at the history, you see that the... laws of Deuteronomy and of P were not known. There is no evidence of them, but there is in fact abundant evidence to the contrary. Now the statement, there's no evidence of them, as we noticed, is a statement which requires the question, is there need of there being evidence of them? The argument from silence can be a good argument, but it can be a very bad argument. There must be real need of such evidence if it is to be valid. But evidence to the contrary is, of course, extremely important. If a man says that he was in China last week, and we look over all the newspapers we can get, we don't find any mention of him having been in China, that doesn't prove he wasn't there. But if he says he was in China last week, and we find a statement in a paper in Austria that he was giving a series of lectures all week in Austria, that's pretty good proof he wasn't in China. So the positive argument is far more effective if it can really be proven than the negative one. And so we looked yesterday at some of the instances that the critics present to show that this law of sacrifice at the one place was not known at the early period. And so they say there was sacrifice offered at Mount Ebal, according to Joshua 8:30-32, Judges 2:5, there's sacrifice. Did I mention Judges 2:5 yesterday? Well, there isn't much said about Judges 2:5, but there is a little bit. And it does mention they're making a sacrifice, the Judges 2:5. And it mentions it in a connection with Gideon, we noticed. And in Judges 6:11-24, that was. We noticed Manoah sacrificing in Judges 13:15-23. And then we noticed Samuel sacrificing in various places. In 1 Samuel 7, 7-10, and in 1 Samuel 9:12. And then we notice Saul in the battle sacrificing in 1 Samuel 15:21. Let's just take a minute and look at the context of that instance. 1 Samuel 15:21. We look at the context and we find that... This was after the taking of the Amalekites. It says, the people took with the spoil sheep and oxen, which should have been destroyed, to sacrifice unto the Lord thy God in Gilgal, Saul said, rather than in Jerusalem. And there was another instance there in connection with Saul, where they had the battle in... against the where the people were very, very hungry, and it's in 1 Samuel 14, and there we read in verse 32, and the people flew upon the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slew them on the ground, and the people did eat them with the blood. Then they told Saul, saying, behold, the people sin against the Lord in that they eat with the blood. You notice they didn't say in that they are sacrificing here instead of in Jerusalem, in that they eat with the blood. And he said, you have transgressed. Roll a great stone unto me this day. And Saul said, disperse yourselves among the people, and say unto them, bring me here every man his ox and every man his sheep, and slay them here. And the word used, translated slay there, is the same word used for sacrifice elsewhere. And sacrifice them here and eat, and sin not against the Lord in eating with the blood. And the people brought every man his ox with him that night, and slew them there, and Saul built an altar unto the Lord. The same was the first altar that he built unto the Lord. Then we have David bring up the ark. We read in 2 Samuel 6:13 how every little distance they made a sacrifice. And then in the same chapter, verses 17 to 18, tell how when they put the ark in the place they were going to keep it, then they made a great many sacrifices. We notice Adonijah in 1 Kings 1:9, where they were going to make him king, and they went outside of Jerusalem, and there they sacrificed great numbers of animals and gave a feast to the people. And as Carpenter says, if it had been illegal to sacrifice anywhere except at the one place, at the temple in Jerusalem, Adonijah, trying to become accepted as king, would hardly have gone outside the city to a different place and sacrificed there. And then Solomon, we noticed in 1 Kings 3, where he went to the great high place in Gibeon, and we read how he sacrificed there, was it 1,000? 1,000 cattle and 10,000 rams, something like that, a very great number that he sacrificed. And instead of rebuking him, God gave him a dream in which he asked him what he would like to have him do for him. Now the case of Elijah I referred to very briefly. In 1 Kings 18:30, we read about Elijah being up on Mount Carmel. And there on Mount Carmel, we read that Elijah built again the altar of the Lord that was fallen. And he built again this altar, and he put a sacrifice on it. And instead of the Lord saying, you have no right to build an altar at Mount Carmel, you must go to Jerusalem to sacrifice, the Lord himself sent fire down from heaven and burned up the sacrifice. In 1 Kings 19:21, you might not at first sight recognize this as a case, as a problem, like in the case of Saul with the animals when they were pursuing the enemy. But in 1 Kings 19:21, we read how he came to the place where Elisha was working. And he left the and Elisha left the oxen after Elijah threw his mantle over him and ran after Elijah and said, let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow thee. And he said, go back again, for what have I done to thee? And he returned back from him and took a yoke of oxen and slew them. And this word slew is the same word for sacrifice. Saw that. He sacrificed them and boiled their flesh with the instruments of the oxen and gave unto the people, and they did eat. Then he arose and went after Elijah and ministered unto him. And this is discussed specifically by Carpenter on page 139, where it says about Elijah that on Carmel he rebuilds the fallen altar, and he witnesses without rebuke the un-Levitical proceedings of Elisha, where the word slew, he says, is strictly sacrificed. Now, of course, when you have an instance where a wicked man does something, that is not a great argument as to what God's law was. It may be something of an argument. It shows something of what that wicked man thought. But when you have a great servant of the Lord, like Samuel or like Elijah, that is quite a different situation. I've been putting all these under instances of the alleged violation of the law of the one place of sacrifice. But you notice you can't strictly separate between that and the law as to who is to perform the sacrifice. Because in all of these same questions, they raise the question, was this man of the family of Aaron? Was he a Levite? Did he break the law of Pi that should be a member of the family of Aaron? Did he break the law of of D that it should be a Levite who would perform the sacrifice. Now let us take capital B. Considerations regarding these alleged violations as proof of non-existence of the Deuteronomic law. Oh, and of course, under A, I did mention yesterday the high places. We have many references in Kings. To a man being a good king, only the people continue to sacrifice on the high places. We have those references. And then Josiah destroyed all these high places. But now a B is considerations regarding these alleged violations as proof of non-existence of the Deuteronomic law. And under that, number one, the law in Deuteronomy is not as strict and as universal as the critics allege. The law in Deuteronomy is not as strict and as universal as the critics allege. It is interesting that the argument of Divetti in about 1820 was that the book of Deuteronomy was primarily written in order to get rid of the other altars, the other places, so that all the income would come to the Jerusalem priests. And for a period of about 100 years, the general attitude of critics was the whole purpose of Deuteronomy was to centralize religion in Jerusalem. Although there were other points also, of course, discussed, but that was the central feature. And then beginning about 1920, a considerable number of the critics have been saying the law for centralization of the worship in Jerusalem is not the primary thing in Deuteronomy. It is not greatly stressed in Deuteronomy. It is hardly found in Deuteronomy except for one chapter. And so the great many of the critics today believe that actually instead of Deuteronomy being written in order to make people go to Jerusalem, that it was written in the northern kingdom. And that it was in the northern kingdom perhaps a century before the time of Josiah, and in some way was brought down to the southern kingdom. And then there was added to it the feature about the sacrifice being limited to the one place. And before it was hidden in the temple in order to be found there. Now, not all critics agree on that by any means. Some even think it's written later on, after Josiah's time today. But probably the bulk still hold the Vedic view, which was written just about at that time. And but it is important here that many do hold that its main purpose is not centralization of worship. And I think that is borne out by the fact that practically everything it says about this is found in one chapter, in chapter 12. Now I ask you to look that chapter over carefully for today and to have a good idea of exactly what the chapter presents. And if you did so, you notice that it does stress the fact that the sacrifice is to be brought into one place. We find right near the beginning, verse 5, "But unto the place which the Lord your God shall choose out of all your tribes to put his name there, even unto his habitation shall ye seek, and there shalt thou come. And there ye shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifice and your tithes and heave offerings of your hand and your vows and your freewill offerings and the firstlings of your herds and of your flocks. And there ye shall eat before the Lord your God, and ye shall rejoice in all that ye put your hand to." Verse 8, "Ye shall not do after all the things we do here this day. Every man whatsoever is right in his own eyes. But ye are not as yet come to the rest and to the inheritance which the Lord your God gives you. But when ye go over the Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God giveth you to inherit, and when he giveth you rest from your enemies round about, so that ye dwell in safety, then there shall be a place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell in. There shall ye bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifice, your tithes, and the heave offerings of your hands, and all your choice vows, which ye vow unto the Lord." Verse 13, "Take heed to thyself that thou offer not thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest, but in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of thy tribes, there thou shalt offer thy burnt offerings, and there thou shalt do all that I command thee." Notwithstanding, thou shalt kill and eat flesh in all thy gates. Now, anybody who read this chapter in the Hebrew has a very interesting question in mind about this 15th verse. Notwithstanding, thou mayest kill and eat flesh in all thy gates, whatsoever thy soul desireth, according to the blessing of the Lord thy God, which he hath given thee. The clean and unclean and the clean may eat thereof. Only ye shall not eat the blood, ye shall pour it upon the earth as water. Thou mayest not eat within thy gates the tithe of thy grain, or of thy wine, or of thy oil, or the persons of thy herds or flocks, nor any of the vows which thou vowest. But thou must eat them before the Lord thy God in the place which the Lord God shall choose. Thou and thy son, thy daughter, thy maidservant, and so on. And then verse 20. When the Lord thy God shall enlarge thy borders, he hath promised thee, and thou shalt say, I will eat flesh, because my soul longeth to eat flesh, thou mayest eat flesh, whatsoever thy soul desireth. If the place which the Lord thy God hath chosen to put his name there be too far from thee, and those of you who, I ask you to study this chapter rather thoroughly, those of you who read it in the Hebrew have similar question about verse 21 here. If the place which the Lord thy God hath chosen to put his name there be too far from thee, then thou shalt kill of thy herd and thy flock which the Lord hath given thee as I have commanded thee. And thou shalt eat in thy gate whatsoever thy soul desires. And so you notice that there is great stress in this chapter about bringing the sacrifices, and particularly bringing the tithes and various matters of this type, the firstlings and so on, to the place the Lord thy God shall choose. It doesn't mention Jerusalem at all. Seems a bit strange if it was written in Josiah's time that they wouldn't have put in the word Jerusalem. But it does stress bringing sacrifices to the one place. But under this heading, the law is not as strict and as universal as the critics allege. We have a small aid which says it was not to be effective until the Lord had given them rest from their enemies. Now that is a pretty strong statement, and that wasn't made once, it was made a couple of times. He says, you here are sacrificing at various places. But he says, after you've gone in and taken the land, and after the Lord has given you rest from your enemies, and you rest safely there, you dwell safely there, then you are not to sacrifice in various places, but you are to bring your sacrifices to the one place which the Lord your God shall choose. That he stresses here in this chapter. It is after the Lord gives them rest from all of their enemies. But then small b. Small b is that Deuteronomy itself provides for a sacrifice at another place. If the purpose of Deuteronomy was simply to lay down a definite, strict law that all sacrifice at all times is to be at Jerusalem, it'd be strange indeed for this same book to provide for a sacrifice at a different place. But in Deuteronomy 27, verses 4 to 8, Deuteronomy 27, 4 to 8, we read, therefore it shall be when ye are gone over the Jordan, that ye shall set up these stones which I command you in Mount Ebal, and thou shalt plaster them with plaster, and there shalt thou build an altar unto the Lord thy God, an altar of stones. Thou shalt not lift up any iron tool upon them. And thou shalt build the altar of the Lord thy God of whole stones, and thou shalt offer burnt offerings thereon unto the Lord thy God. And thou shalt offer peace offerings, and shalt eat there, and rejoice before the Lord thy God. And thou shalt write upon the stones all the words of this law very plainly. And we read in Joshua how that command was fulfilled. Now that is provided in Deuteronomy itself. Is not that a contradiction to the idea that the book of Deuteronomy has as its primary purpose the centralization of all worship at Jerusalem? Well, here's Carpenter's book, The Composition of the Hexateuch. And in this book, he has, toward the latter part, he has a list of all of the verses from Genesis through Deuteronomy, in which he shows to which document he thinks they belong. And the analysis, as he does it, of Numbers and of Exodus and of Genesis, is very lengthy and detailed, because he'll give a verse and a half to this and two verses to that and a verse to this and so on, agreeing with most of the critics in his arrangement. But in the case of Leviticus, he gives most of Leviticus to the P. Doctrine. So that occupies a very small space in his denial. And in the case of Deuteronomy, he divides up Deuteronomy into two different types of parts of the D document. Parts of it he puts under D, G, as he calls it, and parts of it under DS. But they're both parts of a previous thing united together into Deuteronomy. So he gives most of Deuteronomy, nearly everything in Deuteronomy, he gives to D, either to one or the other of the two strands of which he thinks that Deuteronomy was made up. And there are many who divide Deuteronomy into D1, D2, or maybe D1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, but they don't agree very much on these divisions. But he does give a little bit of Deuteronomy, a very little bit, not over the equivalent of two-thirds of a chapter, most, out of the whole book of 34 chapters, does he give to any document except D. And so here he says, chapter 27, he gives entirely to D, to Deuteronomy, that is to the D document, except for verses 5 to 7a, which he says is part of the E document, an altar for sacrifice to be built on Ebal. Well, it's easy enough to prove that a book teaches something if you just take out of it everything that teaches something else and put it in a different document. And that is perhaps a little harder to demonstrate when they divide a book up constantly into many sections. But when you give practically the whole of Deuteronomy to that, then to say that these 2.5 verses, 5 to 7-8, are taken from the E document is certainly letting your theory enter, changing the facts to fit your theory. He gives a very few verses in the whole book to the E document, hardly any to the J document, very, very little to the P document. But as the book stands, it does provide for this sacrifice at Mount Ebal when they first come into the land. Now, actually, of course, this would be before the Lord had given them rest from their enemies round about. So that there certainly is no contradiction between chapter 27 and chapter 12. Because as we notice, chapter 12 is to be effective when the Lord has given them rest from all their enemies and they dwell safely. Well, now when something is to take effect, when the Lord has given their rest from all your enemies and when you're dwelling safely, that doesn't sound as if it's a part of God's great moral law. It is rather a regulation for the preservation of unity, a regulation for the maintenance of control over the general religious life of the land, rather than one of the great moral principles. Sacrifice is important. It prefigures the death of the Lord Jesus Christ. It shows man recognizes himself as a sinner, and recognizes he needs a substitute to die in his place, and sacrifice is very important. But the place of sacrifice is a regulation for the sake of maintaining unity and keeping out the coming in of idolatrous and wicked practice from the other nations. It is in a different category altogether. So we look at these two things under the law in Deuteronomy is not as strict and as universal as the critics allege. And you notice there were two verses I read to you, verse 5 and verse 21, in which it stated that they could slay animals at home if the place was quite a long distance away. They didn't have to bring every animal they slew. All the firstlings had to be brought to Jerusalem. But other animals, if they were not right near, could be slain at home and eaten there, but they must not eat the blood. Now, number two. Number two, as the history stands, It contains evidence that the law of God for centralization of worship was recognized long before the time of Josiah. As the history stands, it contains evidence that the law of God for centralization of worship was recognized long before the time of Josiah. We do not have a great deal of evidence on this point, but we do have some. And what, yes, as the history stands, it contains evidence that the law of God for centralization of worship was recognized long before the time of Josiah. You see, the critics say it was introduced at the time of Josiah. And this is the There were two references there. I referred to them as I went through, but I'm going to look at them again under another point. So suppose I come to them then rather than mention them again now. Yes. Then number two, as the history stands, it contains evidence that the law of God for centralization of worship was recognized long before the time of Josiah. Now I asked you last week, I believe it was, I asked you to look very carefully at Joshua 22 and to see what you find in Joshua 22. And if the idea of centralizing worship in Jerusalem as being a divine command was a new thing in the time of Josiah, it is very strange that the book of Joshua, which as the history stands tells about the early days of their coming into the land, should describe a situation where there was almost a great war between 2.5 of the tribes and the other 9.5 tribes. You remember that chapter 22 here begins with Joshua calling the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribes of Manasseh and thanking them for their having helped in the conquest of the territory west of the Jordan, and telling them now they can return to the land which Moses had conquered for them east of the Jordan, and that they can return there to the land of their possession which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you the other side of the Jordan, but take diligent heed to do the commandments and the law which Moses, the servant of the Lord, charged you, to love the Lord your God and to walk in all his ways, and to keep his commandments and to cleave unto him and to serve him with all your heart and all your soul. And Joshua blessed them and sent them away. But then we read that after they went back across to their land, we read that some of them said, the people across the Jordan in Canaan are separated from us by quite a distance, and they're going to think we really don't have a part in Israel. And so they said, we will build an altar over here. And verse 10 says, when they came to the borders of the Jordan in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben, children of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built there an altar by the Jordan, a great altar to see. And the children of Israel heard they had built this altar there, and they said, isn't that nice? We have our altars over here, scattered up and down through the land to worship the Lord. They're going to build some altars over there too. But that's not what Joshua says they did at all. The book says that the whole congregation of the Lord said, what trespass is this you've committed against the God of Israel, to turn away this day from following the Lord, in that you have built you an altar that you might rebel this day against the Lord? And so they rebuked them for it. The end of verse 19, they say, if you think that land is bad over there, leave it and come over here and take some of this land with us. But rebel not against the Lord, nor rebel against us in building you an altar, in addition to the altar of the Lord our God. Did not Achan the son of Zerah commit a trespass in the accursed thing, and wrath fell on the congregation of Israel? And that man perished not alone in his iniquity. Then the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh answered and said to the heads of the thousands of Israel, the Lord God of gods, the Lord God of gods, he knows, and Israel he shall know. If it be in rebellion or if in transgression against the Lord, save us not this day. that we have built an altar to turn from following the Lord, or if to offer thereon burnt offering or meal offering or to offer peace offering, let the Lord himself require it. And if we've not rather done it for fear of this thing, saying in time to come your children might speak to our children, saying, what have you to do with the Lord our God in Israel? Therefore we said, verse 26, let us now prepare to build us an altar, not for burnt offering or for sacrifice, but that it may be a witness between us and you and our generations after you, that we might do the service of the Lord before him, with our burnt offerings, with our sacrifices, with our peace offerings, that your children may not say to our children in time to come, you have no portion in the Lord. They say in verse 28, we say again, behold the pattern of the altar of the Lord which our fathers made, not for burnt offerings, not for sacrifice, but is a witness between us and you. God forbid that we should rebel against the Lord and turn this day from following the Lord to build an altar for burnt offerings, for meal offerings, or for sacrifices beside the altar of the Lord our God that is before his brethren. And so we have a big argument, and the other tribes are just ready to fight them over their building an altar over there until they explain it is not an altar for sacrifice, it is an altar for a witness like the altar on Mount Ebal, where sacrifices were made before God gave them rest, but where in subsequent years they simply had the law written on the stones that people could see, and it stood for a witness. And so here we have, in the book of Joshua, at the very beginning of the history, we have an evidence in the history as it stands here that the people then felt that this was a very important command of God as given in Deuteronomy, that the sacrifices must be brought to the one place that the Lord your God shall choose, and there sacrificed upon the altar there. Now that, of course, as the history stands, is a complete contradiction to the critical claim that this law was not known until the time of Josiah. However, this is, of course, a very easy thing for the critics to dispose of. All they have to do is, of course, to say that, after all, this chapter of Joshua belongs to the P. Docket and was inserted in Joshua after the time of Josiah. They do not agree as well on the division of Joshua as they do on the division of other books. But in the case of Joshua, they put it in the P document, chapter 22, verses 6 to 24, return of Transjordanic tribes and their altar. Well, of course, with that sort of an arrangement, it's easy to disprove any kind of knowledge. Yes, Mr. Ricketts? They put the first five in the D document, which still would be the time of Josiah for them. No, yes. Yes, it's got the very language of Deuteronomy, very typical, so therefore they have to leave those first five indeed. But still, of course, that makes it, according to them, the time of Josiah. But from there on, they put it in the P document, which presupposes, according to them, and assumes one place, the ark. So I think those two passages, Deuteronomy 27 about Mount Ebal and Joshua 22 about this one, are pretty strong evidences against the critical view. Now, we do not have a great deal of evidence in the Scripture about the recognition that God had prescribed it should be at one place. After all, it is the sort of a thing which would rather naturally be done. That is, once the law was established, you would not ordinarily expect a great deal of occasion to draw attention to it or to refer to it. The lack of such does not prove it was not known. And we do have references to Shiloh, S-H-I-L-O-H. And there is an interesting thing that we read about Eli at Shiloh, about Samuel being there with Eli. We read references to Shiloh as the place where the people brought their sacrifices, where the temple of the Lord was. It was the religious center of the land. And then we read about the great battle in which the Philistines destroyed, defeated the Israelite army and killed the sons of Eli, and Eli himself, when he heard the news, was so upset, he just fell over backwards and broke his neck and died. But there's no mention made there of the fate of Shiloh. And we would not know what happened to Shiloh. But in Jeremiah, we have two or three cases where God declares his wrath upon Jerusalem for its sin and says, if you continue in such sin as you are in, you will become like Shiloh, which was so utterly destroyed. And so here is what, from a historical viewpoint, you might say is one of the most important things in Israelite history, that Shiloh, the great center of the sanctuary, the great home, place where the worship was for the whole land, as is assumed in various statements in Judges in the early part of Samuel, that it was greatly destroyed. And the destruction of Shiloh is not mentioned in the historical books. But it ceases to be mentioned as a place thereafter. And they do mention the great battle and the great destruction of the army and the death of Eli. But as to the actual fact of the destruction of Shiloh, we would not have any definite statement if it were not that Jeremiah refers to it so specifically. It would just seem that it is something which the Israelites were very much aware of, which was so much in their minds as the terrible destruction came to Shiloh, that Jeremiah could simply an offhand way to refer, why, you'll have the terrible fate that came to Shiloh. But in the historical books, they simply do not state the fact. I think that's very important in connection with the history. God did not give us the Old Testament to give us a full, complete history of Israel. He didn't give us the Old Testament to give us a complete history of the universe, to tell us how everything was made, to tell us the details of any one of our various sciences. He didn't give it to us even to give us a full history of Israel. He gave it to show us how we can know the Lord, how we can have our relation to Him, how we can understand our need of a Savior and look, see how they look forward to Jesus Christ. And He touches on these sciences. And where He touches on them, He touches on them correctly. And of course, He tells much more about the history than of any particular science. But He makes no attempt to give a full, complete picture of the history. He tells important things, but always with the particular emphasis of the relation to the Lord. And so Shiloh is the place where the Lord put His name, where the center was for the sacrifice, until Shiloh was destroyed. And then when Shiloh was destroyed, the Philistines took over. And the Philistines, with their possession of iron weapons, which the Israelites did not have, were able to hold the land pretty much in subjection until the time of David. And even when Saul was king, he was constantly fighting to maintain their existence against the Philistines, who were so dominant during the period of Samuel and during the period of Saul. And it is only when you come to David again that you get a condition of security when people can dwell safely in the land. And then David conquers the Jebusite town, the town of Jebus, and makes it into Jerusalem, his great capital. And so you have the law of God for centralization of worship recognized in the history with the preeminency of Shiloh, even though this is not particularly stressed in the history. And then in Kings we have David establishing the center of Jerusalem, but the temple is not yet built, the great center for the worship, until during the reign of Solomon. And so Solomon, at the beginning of his reign, has these sacrifices at Gibeon, a few miles north of Jerusalem. But then he establishes the temple as the great center, and after Solomon's death, when the kingdom is divided, we read in 1 Kings 12, 26, 27, that Jeroboam said in his heart, if this people go up to do sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then shall the heart of this people turn again to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, king of Judah. Whereupon the king took counsel and made two calves of gold, and said to them, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And so when Jeroboam established his altars at Bethel and at Dan, the terminology he uses recognizes the fact that the place which had been the place which the Lord had, people understood the Lord had selected and had put his name there, and where the Lord expected they should, where the people expected they should go to worship, was Jerusalem. So there are these few rather small recognitions of the fact that there was the centralization of worship. But it is not greatly stressed. We must recognize that. Now that's number three. Now number four. Number four, some of the instances are acts of men who are not to be taken as models. You remember how in the arguments about the priesthood, they referred to, this one too, they referred to this man Micah in Judges. Yes? Oh, yes, number four, some of the instances were acts of men who were not to be taken as models. Yes? Number three, didn't I? Yes, thank you. I have three and two. I had them in one order, and I decided the second order was better, so I have two after three. I think we'll go back to it's more logical to put in my original three here than four. So let's go back to three, and we'll come to four again. Three is that some of the alleged violations are the result of insisting on a more rigid sense of the words. Some of the alleged violations are the result of insisting on a more rigid sense of the words Zavach and Mizbeach than their youth warrants. Now for Mr. Huff, how would you spell Zavach? What Hebrew letters would you put in that word? Zavach. Mr. Scott? Zion, Bay, Kit. Zavach. And Zavach is ordinarily translated sacrifice. And Mizbeach is main Zion, Bay, Kit. Mizbeach. And the main is very often placed at the beginning of a verb to make a noun which indicates either a place or an instrument. And in this case, it's both. Because a mizbeach is an altar, a place of sacrifice. And so the words Zavach, to sacrifice, and mizbeach, a place of sacrifice, which we translate as an altar, the critics are in some cases insisting on a more rigid sense of them than their youth warrants. Now, I called your attention to the case where our English Bible says that when Elijah came back from Mount Sinai, he threw his mantle over Elisha. And then it says that, it says in chapter 1 Kings 19:21, that Elisha returned back from him and took a yoke of oxen and slew them. And I read you what Carpenter said, that the word here translated slew is the word which regularly means sacrifice. And Carpenter said that Elijah did not rebuke Elisha for sacrificing the oxen, even though there's no evidence Elisha was a Levite. and certainly this was not at Jerusalem. But he did not rebuke him for this act, contrary, says Carpenter, to the laws of Deuteronomy and of Peter. But you notice, as it is in the English, it just says he slew them. It doesn't say that he sacrificed them. Well, now, is that warranted? Is that justified? Well, look back at Deuteronomy. And in Deuteronomy 12, we have these statements repeated about three times. That the place the Lord shall choose, you shall bring your burnt offerings, your sacrifice, your tithes, and heave offerings, and so on. You shall bring them to the place the Lord shall, your God shall choose. That's where you are to have your sacrifice. But in verse 15, it says, notwithstanding, thou mayest kill and eat flesh in thy gates. And this word here translated kill is the same word thou, translated slay in connection with Elisha, and translated sacrifice in the great bulk of Peter. And therefore, right here in Deuteronomy 12, the very chapter which has the law of the single sanctuary, this word Zavat is used twice. It is used in verse 15 and again in verse 21 of what the people are to do at their homes when they are to slay animals to eat. The word, same word, Zavak, is used. And so we see from that clear evidence that the word Zavak may be used for the killing of an animal, not only to burn before the Lord, but also to eat. And that explains the use of Saul when they were fleeing, when the people started, in their terrible hunger, started killing animals and eating them with the blood, breaking the Lord's law that way, that Saul constructed a mizbah. He put up a stone against which they were to kill the animals and let the blood out in accordance with their law. So that they should not eat the blood and eat it there. It was not sacrifice there, but simply to kill, to slay. And we have the word used right in Deuteronomy 12 twice in that sense. And here it's translated kill or slay, and Carpenter and me just didn't notice that. Yes, Mr. Buck?
I was wondering if DVD was very good for bias recognizing why images of that.
I'm sure they do. I have not looked it up there for a long time. But if you will look it up, I am 99 and 99 hundredths percent sure that you will find that they specifically bring that up. That it is occasionally used to mean to kill for sacrifice. Because right in this chapter here, where it says, bring your sacrifices to this place, it says, if the place is too far, you can kill in your own place, and only you mustn't eat the blood. And it uses the same word. So, I mean, it's absolutely clear. There can be no question whatever about it. And my general impression, though it's a long time since I've looked at it, is that you'll find it clearly brought out in BDD. But Carpenter didn't notice. And so when Carpenter makes a lot about Elisha performing this un-Levitical act in killing these animals and making a feast for his family before he goes after him, and says the word translated slay there is the same word for sacrifice, he simply did not read Deuteronomy 12 in the Hebrew, as I expect many of you did in your preparation for this lesson for today, getting it well in mind. But you may have read it and not noticed this particular point of course. Mr. Yes, the case of Saul there, I did not write down the reference. I had to hunt for it a minute ago. It is in 1 Samuel, 1 Samuel 14. 1 Samuel 14, it would be from verses 32 on. Verse 35, Saul built an altar unto the Lord. The same was the first altar he built unto the Lord. There was an altar which remembered their victory there, but which had been a place simply to kill the animals there, but not a place of sacrifice necessarily. Now the word can be used for sacrifice, but you can't draw it from this statement here, either from Zavak or from Mizbah. Now, number four, which I appreciate Mr. Ricketts calling my attention to, my having skipped three, because three is really very important. Four is that some of the instances were acts of men who are not to be taken as models. And Micah, we've noticed, is described as a man who paid no attention to the law of God, but who wanted to have his own type of religion. And he ordained his son to be priest until a Levite came along, a renegade Levite, and then he asked him to do it. And so, certainly, what wicked people do is not a model of what the Lord's law was. Now, the case of Saul is not quite in that category, because Saul, after all, in his early days, does seem to have tried to follow the Lord before he was filled with pride because of his power and his leadership and turned his heart away from following the Lord. And yet, I think that Saul, in view of his latter end, we certainly could not take him as a model in any sense. But I don't think you need to bring that in this case, because I think the other point we mentioned is quite sufficient in regarding to it. And also a later point that we are going to mention, but that I fear we have to leave until tomorrow.